Well, without further ado, thank you very much, everyone, for attending. My name is Joe Bach. I'm the president of the Rutgers Federalist Society. Joining us today, we are proud to have Dr. Christina Hoff Summers. She's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, one of the nation's foremost conservative think tanks located in Washington, D.C. The American Enterprise Institute was founded in 1943. It's home to some of the nation's top scholars, including Jonah Goldberg and Newt Gingrich. Now, Dr. Summers is a former philosophy professor. She taught at Clark University for a number of years. She's written several very popular books, including Who Stole Feminism? The War Against Boys, and she also wrote a textbook, Vice and Virtue in Everyday Life, that ethics classes and undergraduates throughout the country use. She recently edited The Debate on Women in Science, and she's preparing to write a book on the lost history of conservative feminists. And today, she will be giving us a lecture on college sports and Title IX. Thank you, Dr. Sorry, two more things. We do have a sign-in sheet going around, so if you could all sign in, that would be great. And following Dr. Hoff Summers' lecture, we will have a brief question and answer period. Thank you.
You mentioned I was on Oprah.
She has also appeared on Oprah Winfrey Show and on the Jon Stewart Show.
And he was nice to me. Well, just to give you a little background about myself, I am a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, yes, the premier conservative think tank in our opinion. And I've been there for about 10 years. Before that, I taught philosophy for many years at Clark University, where I began as a very liberal professor, and I was asked one year to teach feminist philosophy. The chair of my department asked, and this was in the early 90s, I sent away for the textbook, assuming that it would be what was always in philosophy textbooks. This was sort of reasoned opinions on both sides of arguments, and, you know, there'd be essays for and against abortion, or comparable worth, or surrogate motherhood. That was not what I found in these books. They were, they could have been renamed Paranoia 101. They were these elaborate and implausible theories about the capitalist heteropatriarchal oppression of American women, and they came with these outrageous statistics and twisted, warped view of the world, and it was relentless. Now, it didn't bother me that there was radicalism in these textbooks, but I wanted the counterpoise. Where was the moderate view? Where was the balance? And I couldn't find it. So I began to argue with my colleagues. And in fact, I went to the American Philosophical Association and challenged some of these opinions. And typically, if you go to the American Philosophical Association and you challenge your colleagues, you know, you have arguments and then you get kind of bitter. But then you all go out for drinks. You part as friends. We did not part as friends. We did not go out for drinks. I was excommunicated from the Society of Women in Philosophy because they actually considered it heretical. Now, these were very radical feminists at the time, and I don't know that you would, I think it's changed and it's more moderate these days. However, the groups that I was arguing with at the time, they became quite powerful in the universities, and especially the women's organizations, and they get their way. Their worldview prevails in these organizations. And this evening, I'm going to talk about what's happened with Title IX, when bad things happen to good laws, because originally, and this is the kind of thing I would have debated my colleagues years ago, is that I considered myself an equity feminist. An equity feminist is someone who wants for women what she wants for everyone, fair, basic fairness, equality of opportunity, equality of dignity. But as an equity feminist, I don't insist that men and women be exactly the same. I don't insist that there be, I want equality of opportunity, but not necessarily equality of outcome. You give people the opportunity, you open the doors, and then if they want to go through, fine. If they don't, that's also their choice. And it's my opinion that men and women don't always make the same choice and how we live our lives and the fields we go into. But my colleagues who were more hard line, and some of them were very hard line, just to give you an example, the first class that I taught in philosophy, in feminist philosophy, I sent away for textbooks, and one of them arrived by Joyce Treblecott from Washington University. And she dedicated the book to the students in my Women's Studies Aguilar in the spring of 92. And I hadn't seen the word Aguilar before, and I was thinking, oh, what is that? I was about to look it up in the dictionary until I realized that she'd made it up. She doesn't like the word seminar because its root word is associated with the very essence of male power, and so she changed it to what she took to be a feminist equivalent. And it was funny, but she wasn't kidding. And so that was that's the mindset. They're very serious. And I find it increasingly irrational, and I'm just going to set the Tide Minds case up as an example of what's gone wrong. Now, the first thing to say is that it is the Title IX, as it was originally intended by legislators, and beginning with Edith Green, who was a congresswoman from the state of Oregon, the purpose was to open up the doors in education, not only in sports, but in all fields, and give women the same opportunities as men. Title IX was simply an amendment to the education bill that said that you will not discriminate on the basis of gender. And you can't have a program and no women allowed. And Americans, certainly members of Congress, thought it was fair and reasonable. And it passed without much trouble. But over the years, the groups that I talked about, where that I was arguing with in the early 90s, and they began to take power, and in their organizations, the women's groups that had once been moderate, like the American Association of University Women, the National Women's Law Center, these groups began to adopt a philosophy that it wasn't enough that women had equal opportunity. As I said, they wanted to see proportionality. For example, in sports, as women were increasingly dominant on the campus, 40, 50, 60 now, well not more than 60, but now it's around 57% of our undergraduates are female. They said, well, that has to be reflected in the number of athletes that you have. If you have 52% female in your school, you should have 52% athletes. Now again, that was not the intention of the bill. The intention of the bill was to simply offer the opportunities. It wasn't a quota system. It wasn't an enforced parity. But groups, also the Women's Sports Foundation, which is one of the oldest and most prestigious of the women's advocacy groups, it's led by Billie Jean King, they have now produced something they call the Title IX report card. And they go to every school and they give it a grade, like, are you at proportionality? And if someone was here from one of these organizations, she would say to you, oh, we hear all these complaints about how men's teams are being eliminated, and you know, the wrestlers and the gymnasts and the swimmers, they're all complaining. But in fact, even today, there are still more male athletes on campuses. There are very few schools that have achieved proportionality. In fact, in her list, most schools received an F or D. There were very, very few that had even passing grades. Now, one other thing I'll tell you before I go a little more deeply into the story. In Washington, D.C., and around, I guess, mostly the Northeast, there are about 112 major women sort of think tanks, advocacy groups, and they're gathered into a council called the National Council for Research on Women. Now, you haven't heard of them, you don't think about them, but they are, many of these organizations are as big as any of the think tanks in Washington, D.C. They're full of lawyers. They work day and night, and they kind of canvass the environment. They scour it for any place they find where women are falling behind men. Now, that makes sense. Why should we say they're women's organizations? But now let me put it into a larger context. Let's just look at the American campus, where, as you probably heard, or even go to high school. If you go to a graduation, far more girls than boys now go to college. Girls are winning most of the honors. If you have a valedictorian, probably the exception is the young men in this room. You were probably honor students, but you would know that many of your friends in your high school, especially if you went to a public high school, the boys are falling behind in ways which are dramatic and worrisome. There is a reading gap, a literacy gap, that's a chasm. There are just vast numbers of young men who just are not part of the culture of the written word. This is a dangerous situation. They're going to find it very hard to make a place for themselves in a knowledge-based economy. So what we see now is, starting with Title IX and kind of educational revolution that took place where all the doors were open to women, women went through in great numbers and great success. And you now have women getting 57% of the bachelor's degrees, a majority of the master's degrees, and as of 2 years ago, a majority of the PhDs. And there are now fields which were once male-dominated that we find now women are all but taking over. It's fields like psychology, veterinary medicine, for some reason, is the field that was once 70-80% male, now reversed. And women, it's difficult to get into vet school, but almost as hard as the VCATs as the MCAT, the medical school exam, but these young women are great students, determined. And so all over, you're seeing this ascendancy, and it's impressive, and I tell you, as a college teacher, I saw it in my classroom. Increasingly, but what's happened on many of our campuses, especially the small liberal arts colleges, there are far more girls than boys, or more young women than men. However, we've got these women's organizations. We don't have men's organizations, and I'm not even saying we should, but I hope that these women's organizations stop doing what they're doing. Now let me tell you a little about that. They are relentless. Now you may have heard about men's teams evaporating on campuses. Just this week, yesterday, there was an announcement that the rugby team and the swimming team at Berkeley were going to be disbanded, or they would lose their varsity status, and they weren't going to be supported by the university. We've seen wrestling, any of the sports which don't produce a great deal of money. If it's football or basketball, those are pretty safe. But any team other than that, and you want to achieve parity in your school, how do you do it? Now, some schools are wealthy enough that they can just have everybody doing everything. But most schools can't. And what ended up happening is that suppose that you had on your campus, you know, 57% of your undergraduate enrollment was female, but you were only attracting about 40% of them to your athletic teams. What do you do? And in the end, what happened on many campuses is they just reduced the level of male participation to that of female interest. So if the, you know, and you just if there were girls on the teams, you got it up. You want to get try to get as close to parity as you could. But of course, they just never get there because there's not the same interest among the women as the men. Now, that's not to say that there's no interest. If we all know many, many young women who are fantastic athletes, just as interested, just as obsessed in sports, there just aren't as many. It's just a different pool, the pool of, and we've got a lot of data on this. They'll ask, few studies, and UCLA every year surveys attitudes of freshmen, and how much did you play sports, and what, you know, per week, and there's a certain percentage of kids that was just kind of obsessed with it, and they tend to be far more male than female. If you look at who subscribes to Sports Illustrated, it's mostly men, and they tried to get a woman's Sports Illustrated, based on this idea that there was this passionate constituency of women athletes that would want to get women out of business in 2 years. If you look at sports magazines, there are dozens of them, and most of them are bought by men, but then you go down to the number one, not the number one, but if you go down to about 40, you finally get a successful women's sports magazine, and it's Cheerleader. That's the name of the magazine. Now, here's the conundrum. Colleges right now are desperate to get more males, and some of them are practicing affirmative action for boys. You have to, or you would just, it would be so skewed, and nobody wants that. The girls don't want it. And the boys, some of the boys don't mind it if they go to school, which is 60% to 70% female. But overall, students like to have, the administration likes to have a balance. So they recently, colleges have come up with this idea, well, we'll offer more sports teams. Like if you set up a football team, this was an article in the New York Times about 4 years ago, that Utica College in New York, men were disappearing from the campus, Seton Hill in Pennsylvania, Shenandoah in Virginia, and all three of them decided they were going to just expand, or in these cases, they were going to initiate a football team. And as one of the athletic directors, I think it was from Shenandoah, said to the New York Times, you would be hard-pressed to find any marketing expert who could get you 100 new paying male students in 1 year, but if you add a few football coaches, and you know, you can do it. In fact, you could have 200 if you want. But so, for whatever reason, you could disapprove of it if you want. Should males just be going to college because they want sport? Well, that's one attraction for young men. And we have a huge gap favoring females. So you could add a football team to attract young men. Here's the problem. As soon as you do that, you're going to be running afoul of Title IX. Which says you have to have proportionality. And it's so absurd, I'll just give you an example. Howard University is traditionally African American college in Washington, famous, but it is now 67% female. But women are only 43% of its athletic program. So the Women's Sports Foundation, Billie Jean King, her group, they gave it an F, fail. Howard gets an F because of this proportionality gap. Now, in about 5 or 6 years ago, they cut men's wrestling. They always cut wrestling. Some wrestlers said, wrestling survived the fall of Rome, but it's not going to survive Title IX. I don't know what they have against wrestling, but anyway. That was cut, and they cut men's baseball, and they added women's bowling. And they still didn't narrow the gap. You still had all these guys that wanted to play sports, and they just couldn't get anywhere near a sufficient number of females. And unless they cut about half of their current male athletes, it's going to remain on that list, Billie Jean King's list of failures. And they'll be subject to potential threats. Now here's what the wrestling coach Wade Hughes said to the Washington Post, quote, the impact of Title IX's proportionality standard has been disastrous because far more males than females are seeking to take part in athletics. So if Howard University has only 33% males, and if young men in general are only, you know, about 40% of our college population, I ask myself, why isn't that a Title IX? Why isn't that a Title IX issue? If we're, they say, well, girls are an underserved population because they're only, you know, they're not getting their proportionate number of seats, you know, places on athletic teams. Why can't we say that we're underserving young men if they're only, you know, 40% of our college students? They appear to be. And another thing is, if you look at every other activity, you may remember this from high school or college. Women are overrepresented on everything else, school clubs, and honor societies, drama, and so forth. Women's groups seem to follow this unusual logic, which is that anytime that women are lagging behind men, then that is an injustice. It must be aggressively targeted. But when men are lagging behind women, that's a triumph of equity to be celebrated and then just move on. They don't. And analyze it. Now, let me just give you one more example of how far this goes. Have any of you heard of Aviation High School? Mm. I've never heard of it. I didn't even know there was such a thing. But
there's one near LaGuardia Airport.
Right, that's it. Okay. It's in Queens. Mm-hmm. and it's a school with a special focus on aeronautics and aviation, as you might imagine. But it's also 75 to 80% Hispanic, African American kids, a lot of kids from low-income families, and it has a strong appeal to students who thrive in a setting where I visit the school. Half the day they do English and math, and the other half the day they're working on, I think it was FedEx donated a 747 to the school, and the kids go and have internships and tinker with this thing, and they take all these courses, and they have to actually construct a motor from scratch, and with all the raw materials, they take courses in these topics. And they can sign up for these internships at hangars at JFK. Anyway, they have a tremendously successful program, very low dropout rate, high college matriculation rate, but there's one problem. It's 80% male. By the way, I went there, and the girls that are there are fantastic, and they love it, and they want to be there. But they're never going to, they don't appear to be able to attract many more girls than that. And then they try very hard, but they just have far more guys that want to do this than girls. Now, to me, as an equity feminist, not that surprising. To me, the sexes are different, although there are exceptions. We needed feminism because there are people who defy the stereotype, and you have to make a place for them in a fair society. Well, the National Women's Law Center, the AAUW, the same groups that are insisting that we have proportionality, you've got 50% women, you have to have 50% students, 50% on your team, they're going after aviation high school. They're saying that this is an example of, you know, on the basis of Title IX. So now we're going from, it's happened in sports, and there's been a huge, impact on male teams, and now they're moving towards programs like that, and to math and science, because if I were to show you a chart and a graph, there, women, you know, I said before, psychology, PhDs, degrees, it's 70% women. Humanities, it's not that high, but getting to be, and for the PhDs, certainly for the undergraduate degrees, anthropology, all those fields. But there are two fields where you still find far more than women. What would you think those would be? Generally, math and science, but actually not all science. Biology, women are thriving and moving up and probably getting the Nobel Prizes in a few years. But it's the physical sciences. It's the math-based field. It's math, yes, physics, chemistry, engineering. And if you go to almost any college, all these things have changed in American society. Over the, you know, since the dawn of feminism and so forth, we've had several decades, but it's still the fact that the most popular undergraduate major is education for females, and for males it's engineering, and it's still about 70, 30, or 80, 20, I mean it's just very, very powerful and persistent tendency. Now, as I said, if you ask, I think it's reasonable to say that males and females are different. If you look at the evidence, males have better spatial reasoning abilities, there's a rotating three-dimensional objects in their brains, their minds. Girls have better verbal skills. Males are bigger risk takers, thrill seekers. Look at any kind of crazy, off-the-wall, hyper, super dangerous sport. There will be women there, but they'll be far more guys. Males, both are competitive. Men and women are both very competitive, but in slightly different ways. And little boys, their characteristic play is classified by playground experts. It's called rough and tumble play. And it involves a lot of running, chasing, fleeing, sound effects, often accompanied by, you know, screaming. Now little girls do it too, but boys do it a lot more. And when I was writing my book, The War Against Boys, I read about an experiment by Hasbro Toy Company in New York City, in Providence, Rhode Island, where they brought a lot of kids in to do when they were thinking of marketing this house slash sort of a playhouse slash fort to kids, and they were wondering how the children would interact with it. And they brought boys and girls in, and the girls played constructively with the house, and, you know, put the dolly in, the doll perished, played, you know, they were making meals and so forth. And the boys came and, without exception, just took the baby carriage and catapulted it from the roof. And the researchers said they really are different. And just one other example, and then back to Title IX. There's a book written by Vivia, I always forget her middle name, Vivia Gusson Paley. And she was a MacArthur Genius Award winner, but her specialty, she was an expert on early childhood education. And she wrote a book in the early 80s about what it was like to teach 5 and 6 year old kids. And I'm just going to tell you her observation about boys and girls and then get back to Title IX. She describes what it was like to take the kids in her school, these are young kids, 5, 6 years, to a tumbling room where they could just run around and tumble, throw themselves on the wall. I don't know what they did. There were structures and ladders and mats. They could go crazy. Quote, "The boys run and climb the entire time they are in the room, resting momentarily when they fall down dead. When the girls are left alone in the room without the boys, they run and climb and become much more active. But then after a few minutes, they suddenly lose interest and move on to quieter activities. Let's paint. Let's play in the doll corner. Boys, on the other hand, never lose interest in the tumbling room. They leave only when forced to. No boy," says Miss Paley, "ever exited on his own." All right, well, by the time these kids get into high school or college, I think these tendencies are still there. I think if you look at how we are in college, the girls are, they're in the tumbling room, but they're also in the art program, and they're in the anthropology and humanities and dance and drama and so forth. A high percentage of young men are still drawn to the tumbling room. And if they can't be in it, they want to be near it. So we even look to see sports fans. I wrote a paper the other day because there'd been a report from a feminist center at USC about how outrageous it was that after all these changes and improvements in women's participation in sports, the sports page and the cable news is still dominated by men's sports, by the NFL and by the NBA, and they were really angry that the WNBA got so little attention. And I looked into this and found out that people don't like the WNBA. and people said, oh no, but if they were exposed to it more, the more they are exposed to it, the more they really don't like it. And now the comedians have done it, and the women, there are women, not as many, something like 25, percent of like intense sports fans are women, 75% are men, but even those women sports fans, they like the male teams too. So I don't understand this idea that you can kind of force people, it's some law of equity that you have to watch these women's teams. But anyway, as I said, by the time they get to the, well, let me ask you this, how many of you have fantasy teams? Okay, well, it's a room of all guys, but it's, you don't have, it's unbelievable. It's almost, you don't see this kind of breakdown, but it's like 95% of the people that have fantasy teams are male. There's just, it's just a difference in terms of interest, fascination, fixation. So when it comes to college, you've got all these guys who are behind academics, look, if there's one thing that draws them to school and will keep them in college, and they are more interested in engineering and the physical sciences, and they are more interested in sports. Those are the two things the women's groups are targeting now with a vengeance. And they're doing it with the law, and they're doing it almost unopposed because of that structural asymmetry. They've got those, I just mentioned those 112 women's groups in the National Council for Research on Women that are working night and day on this issue. And I understand their point of view. They want to break down the gender system. There was once a feminist philosopher that I debated, Sandra Lee Bartke, and she said that we're all born into society, which she described as a sex-gender system. And she said, we're all born, I'm paraphrasing, but this is close, we're all born bisexuals, and then through socialization, we are transformed into male and female gendered personalities, one destined to command, the other to obey. I read it to my husband once. Now, which one commands? But anyway, just going back, if you've had any exposure to feminist theory, you'll know this is a popular theory that it's socialized, that it's socially constructed, that we're just kind of born as very malleable, and then you're sort of like silly putty, and then society shapes you into male and female, and that's your destiny. Now, I just don't happen to agree with that. I mean, reasonable people disagree, and I don't say there are some interesting arguments for the social construction theory. But on the other hand, there's so much evidence that it's hardwired, and that all the things that I'm talking about, the fact that guys are more interested in systems and in you know, the math-based fields, and women are more drawn to fields that engage them emotionally, psychologically, or they want to study living things and not inert things that are, and they don't want to be in the people-free zones as much as the men. Now again, when I say these things, there's always someone who will say, she said women don't want to, you know, do sports, or she said women don't want to be physicists. No, she didn't. I'm simply saying that the pool of people is much smaller. And the pool of women that are fixated and fascinated with sports and whose life depends on it and who would really kind of stay more attuned and connected to school is far more males than females. Because just because of going back to that tumbling room, and the girls are just so much more interested in so many other things. So in my view, this celebrated Title IX equity law, which has done so much to help women, and I'm grateful to it as an equity feminist, but it's done gratuitous harm, and it needs to be reformed, because I think the potential for havoc and destruction is now enormous as it moves from sports, which is just sad just to do that, but it moves to math and science, which I think is actually dangerous. Imagine if we have to reduce men's participation in science to the level of female interest, when females are simply less interested, in, certainly in the physical sciences, which are fields that certainly drive the economy. So just this kind of, this mindset, but this is not abstract, folks. I'm in Washington, D.C., there's a new law that they're trying to pass, the Fulfilling the Potential of Women in Science and Engineering Act. And they just snuck it into the a bill to reauthorize the funding for NSF and so forth. And I told Congressman about it, and mention his name, because he later rued the day that he ever did it, because he tried to get it stopped. And then these women's groups went after him. His office, the faxes and the phone telling him that he was opposed to the progress of women and so forth. And that's the problem, because we have these groups that are so highly charged. So what is my solution? Well, I don't really have an answer as to what to do. There is the, just in terms of sports, there is the, there's the College Sports Council, which is trying to bring some sanity into this assault on the male team. But it was lawyers trained in law schools like this one that did play a major role in corrupting a once innocent and good law. But on the more positive side, I think that it's future lawyers like those in this room who are in an excellent position to set things right. So I hope that's what you do. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Hoff-Summers. Now we're going to proceed to the question and answer period. And I'd just like to ask everyone to please, when you ask your question, make your question brief and to the point, and only one question per series.
Can you point me in the direction of something that makes the argument cogently why the Academy should be supporting sports at all?
Well, I know there are a lot of professors who don't like it. They don't like the fraternities. They don't like, you know, the sports. The thing is that these are traditions. And I've watched it up close because I have two sons that went to colleges and were sports fanatics and in fraternities. And it's just a source of enjoyment and meaning and esprit de corps. And, you know, if you take away that, I think a lot of people would say you're just taking away the texture and the color and the excitement and the emotion of life. And it, maybe it's not completely logical and rational, and we'd be better if we didn't have this nonsense, but people really enjoy it. And they, so that's why I think they'll never give it up. But it does put, here's what it does create, is this, not to get too technical about it, but because basketball and March Madness and all that, there's a lot of happiness to be seen in that period and with their fantasy teams. And then the football on the college, so those are the two huge things, the and women's basketball too. But mainly it's this football and basketball. But that takes up so much resources that there's very little left for the non-revenue generating sports. Because it's mostly men's, you know, they're spectacular teams. That's why there's so no places left for the wrestlers and the gymnasts and so on. So someone said, well, why don't we just take basketball and football, let's just take that, let's bracket that. And that's part of that tradition. Whereas these other sports are really just, you know, they're the Olympic sports and they're not, it's not part of it. It's not commercial. But when the women's groups always say no, because they have this vision of men and women being, is kind of unisex society. We have to be. Yes?
If you go by interest alone, like if you say we're going to have sports based on interest, then you might have a situation where if women don't have any sports left, like 95% would be men, and you only have maybe 5% or 2% of sports dedicated to women. So the question is, do you have to have some kind of a line? I mean, is there a line you cannot go under? Should there be a line?
Well, I think it's a very good question, because here's what happens, is that there are women that are sports obsessive, just like men, and not only as athletes themselves, but interested. So they're already there. So just I think common sense is the guide, which is that you often, and that's what they tried to do about 8 years ago in Washington. There was a move to say, okay, we're not going to keep taking these cases to court and get exact proportionality. We're going to do a survey and ask how many of you are interested in sports and would participate and see if we're meeting the demand. And that was thought to be just a great compromise. That we'll, you know, and then if we find out there's all this demand, all these women are interested. But what you find is you'll get maybe 30 or 40%, and you ought just get more men that want to, more males that want to do it than females. And that seems fine to me, because I don't understand why that's not fine. Now, to be fair to the other side, they will say, but women don't know they're interested. Maybe you were suggesting that. Maybe until they, but now we do know. I mean, we've seen it. And some women are and some will never be. But here's another thing I'll add, another wrinkle, is that there is a sport that women seem to really like, and it is cheerleading. And I don't mean sideline cheerleading. I mean these cheerleading competitive stunts and gymnasts. Have you seen it? And they compete against one another, and they can attract like 30, 40, and huge teams. They're very popular, but just now we had a case in the Quinnipiac University College, where they were not allowed to count that as a Title IX. They could not be fulfilling Title IX. And it was sad for these young women, because they are not standing on the sidelines with pom-poms. It's really much more, it's competitive, and it's much more like a sport. And this federal judge just said, no, doesn't count. And the women's groups were very happy, because they thought, well, we don't want women being cheerleaders. It has all sorts of associations. But I'm just thinking, like, what? I mean, yes, if you're a hardline feminist, you think it's terrible. But most women don't think of it that way. They should take, at least take a survey, see how we feel, and women do like that. And of course, you have dance programs. Those are dominated by women. And by your question, you can say, well, what is in a dance program? And it was only 5% men and 95% women. Well, it probably is. And that's not problematized in Title IX. Yes?
What authority, I mean, aside from the practical evolution of constitutionalism in America, what enumerated power does Title IX fall under in terms of congressional authority? Where do equal protection, is that what they're claiming?
Well,
how is this a federal law?
Originally, it was part of the equal protection. And what was very interesting, and this is how things work in Washington, which is so dismaying to me to see it up close, is that there weren't all these big controversies. There was some friction as women moved in to take more of their of the resources from athletic programs. But in 1979, there was an official in the Department of Education. Her name was Norma Cantu, and she. A lot of colleges said, we really don't know what is a safe harbor. We don't want to run afoul of Title IX because you lose your federal funding and no one wants that. And she rewrote the regs and she said, there are three ways you can fulfill, in the past she said there were three ways you could fulfill it. You could show that you were meeting demand, you could show that you were gradually moving towards equity, or you could have proportionality. You can have, if you've got 56% women and you've got 50% athletes, that's your safe harbor. That's the way to go. And the colleges then thought, okay, that's where we have to go. That's our, because nobody, you know, people, it makes you nervous that you're going to be sued and losing your money. And athletic directors don't have a lot of power that they can be ordered. That's why I'm wondering if the scientists are going to be as easy to manage as the athletic directors will. And the scientists are professors and they'll just fight back. It won't be as easy to force them to have proportionality in a physics department. But forgetting that for a moment, that's how they did it. So it started out as, yes, a law that was based on equal protection and then evolved into, mutated into a quota regime that's quite merciless and irrational given all the other areas where women are ahead of men. Yeah.
I'm just kind of curious about what provisions of Title IX allow a proportionality argument to be made. It seems like other areas of equal protection, they don't allow that kind of argument. There are a lot of Supreme Court cases where they flat out reject quota systems. So I'm kind of wondering how legally they can make an argument like that.
Or the Michigan cases.
But I thought that those reject quota systems.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They do. I'll tell you, if you want to have an unpleasant experience, just go and read these cases like Brown University. Lost a case where, I think it was 96, they were a great example of a school that was doing right by women and offering every conceivable team, but then they had to cut back a little and they took an equal amount of men's and women's teams, and the women sued and it went to a court and Brown was able to show that they had satisfied demand and that they, it was just one sport they were eliminating, but they were giving women all these other sports. And they had at the time, I forget the exact statistics, but 52% women, and women were, you know, 43% of the athletes. And the judge ruled that Brown was guilty of discrimination, that these women were victims of, unfairness and invidious treatment by Brown, and that they were protected by Title IX, and they were ordered to move towards proportionality. And after that, every college was put on a notice, and that was in 96, and one case after the other, the men's teams lose. And here's what I think happens. I watched this case at Quinnipiac with the cheerleaders. You had a case where there were like four young women that played volleyball, and their coach was very expensive, and stipulate Quinnipiac was playing games with the numbers because they want to have some guys there. This school was like, I don't know, 63%, 64% female. They want to come back. So it goes to court, and They, oh, so they had a cheerleading squad that was the competitive kind, and if that could count, and they took it to the judge, and as I told you, this judge said, no, it doesn't count, and you have to, now they have to go back and move, you know, I forget, they're going to try to get, they're desperate to find something that they can attract as many women that want to play, and so there's no common sense, and it is a quota. And you're absolutely right, it seemed to me to be, I couldn't believe he ruled that way. What I think happened is I think that they're imagining that these women's groups, a lot of the feminist lawyers come to them, and they present it in very poignantly as a civil rights case, that you're here, this is like Brown versus the Board of Education, and separate but equal is not equal. And that's like a very powerful history in our law. And that's what, and those women's groups, they feel that way. But I'm standing there, I don't feel that way, because men and women are not like blacks and whites. Blacks and whites, the differences are superficial between the races. And that is not a basis for differential treatment. But the differences between men and women are not superficial, particularly our preferences, propensities, interests, life priorities. And there's just a vast reservoir of evidence that we are different. And you have to be careful about that because, as I said, there'll be exceptions. There will be the girl that wants to go to aviation high school. And I met them and they were formidable and they were fascinated with what they were doing. But I immediately think of what most young women would say about going there. And they would not be excited about it. But that's the way I see it. But that's the fallacy. So I think that why do they rule in that way is that they see themselves as sort of heroic in bringing about an equitable and fair and just and good society. And I see what they're doing is making us a less happy society and a less free society, and that people, what they're doing now is a lot of young women who are maybe not even that interested in sports are getting scholarships because they have to fill the position. And young men are, there are fewer and fewer sports opportunities. But now, as I said, beginning to happen, math and science with greater confidence. Yes?
This is stepping away from Title IX a little bit, but you had mentioned in your speech the term hardwired, referring to presumably some kind of differences in why men and women pursue different things. I wonder if you can clarify that a little bit, whether it's more like intellectual capacity or strictly what leads people to different interests, and whether you think that separates you in a way from, I think, the former president of Harvard University got in trouble for making certain comments along those lines.
Well, if you go back and look at his comment, he actually didn't say anything that terrible. He wasn't even asserting that this was the case. He was saying this might be the case, it could be this, because he was asked, why are there so few women in the very high echelons of academic science? And one of the things he said, which is true, if you take an intelligence test, what you find is a kind of bell curve with at the tail, that they were going to say, the very extremes of the ability distribution. People, I don't mean just smart, the average IQ of men and women is the same, there's no difference, and men shouldn't get any, take any pride from this, because the average IQ is the same, but it's high end of the ability distribution, with people with freakishly high IQs who have more males. And at the other end, people with freakishly low IQs, you have more males. So it balances out. And that's why, but if you look at, and there could be, those people with those 160 IQs or whatever, then there's that Asperger that we hear a lot about, the high functioning autistics. I've met them. I had my field, the logicians and so forth. Some mathematicians. There are far more males who have that condition. So, you know, that's a way in which it could be physiological. However, when I look at so there is that possibility that might explain that there may be an ability to, but I don't think it explains enough. I think it's what the second thing you said, which is interest. And I think that there's just, it even goes back to studies they've done with primates, vervet monkeys. They showed you know, male and female vervet monkeys, and they could play with a contraction, a kind of a, some kind of a little tool, or they could go for a vervet monkey doll. And the females tended to go for the doll, and the males went for the contraption. And even today, human beings, you ask a little boy or a girl to draw something, you try it with a 3 or 4 year old, and she'll almost always draw a person, and he'll almost always draw a thing. And then, you know, it goes on from there. But there are theories. There's a Simon Baron Cohen at Cambridge University who thinks he's trying to measure this, but there's in the early, that's hormonal, and an exposure to androgens. And we have a very interesting example of girls with something called adrenal hyperplasia, a congenital adrenal hyperplasia. And these are girls that are born with exposed to very high levels of male hormones in the gestation period. And they, it's a genetic disorder, but they're born with, and they have the same play preferences as boys. They will go for the, if I had a little girls and boys here, the girls would tend towards the dolls and the glittery ponies and the boys towards the contraptions and the weapons and so forth. And the girls with this condition, they have the same preferences as the boys. So, you know, but again, I don't want to carry on about this too much because we don't fully understand it. And I do with the people that think that we're malleable and we can be changed. I mean, it's possible. There is a book you should read by John Colapinto called As Nature Made Him, which is about a boy who there was an accident when he was a newborn, which we won't describe in detail. It was a botched circumcision, that's all I'll say. And the doctor just said, oh, well, that's all right. We'll just raise him as a girl. And we'll, you know, later we'll have to give him some hormone treatments and things, but let's just kind of use little surgical things here and there. But right away, as soon as you can, you know, the mother would say, put a dress on him and tell him he's a girl. So I think his name was David, or I forget what it is, but he became Brenda. And it was gender terrorism. If you read this book, what happened to him? He was a freak. And he knew, in his mind, he knew who he was. He knew what he was. And he would, you know, amazing things. Anyway, it ended horribly. And the happiest day of his life was when he found out when he was 17 or something. His parents told him. And finally, it made sense to him. And then he went back to become a guy. And whatever, it didn't end well. But anyway, that sort of thing, the idea that we're so, you know. In fact, actually, my study about books like that, it made me much more committed to the cause of gay rights. Because a gay person, I just think your gender identity I don't want to say hardwired, but I think it runs so deep to who you are. And I think that there are people, not only is there variation if people are gay and straight, but I think there are people that are super feminine, women, I mean there's a range, but there are a lot of women who are very feminine, and men who are like macho, more, or just masculine, whatever those conventional meanings are, and that's who they are. If you force them to change, if you force, you know, there's, just like I told you about aviation high school and all those boys, 80% boys, there's the fashion high school in New York, which is almost all girls. And if you said, okay, we're going to switch, and you girls are going to go over to aviation, and the boys are going to go to fashion industry high, it would be like, I could just see it. We're not that. I just think that it runs very deep. And this is the last thing I'll say about this. I think the women's movement in the United States is the, you know, wholly owned subsidiary of one group of women who really believe in androgyny. And they don't sympathize with feminine women or women that want to stay home with kids or, you know, have traditional feminine. And they vilify, they demonize masculinity. And if you read the bottom of these feminist textbooks, it looks as though it's a pathology in need of a cure. They take your worst case sociopathic male, and in some, not all these textbooks, but in many of these women's studies textbooks, masculinity is presented as toxic, dangerous, something to recover from. Now that's their perspective. and that would be fine if there was balance in the women's movement, that they own it. So that's another one of my hobby horses, that I want to not take back the women's movement. I don't want it just for me, but I want some variety. I want some balance.
Now, the New Jersey Interscholastic Athletic Association, which is the governing body for high school sports in New Jersey, came out with a study that high school athletes perform better in the classroom during their academic seasons. Now, as a former varsity college athlete, you know, I've lived through what I believe were the benefits of playing sport in college. I definitely think that, I haven't seen studies, but I think that it entices students to go to college, and ultimately I think it's a good thing for society. I also have a younger sister who was a varsity athlete in college. So through both of us, I saw this benefit. And so my question really is, isn't this a good thing that the government should be encouraging more? Could it encourage more females to go to college? And
yes, I have read enough about it to find all sorts of benefits that come from being in sports. And I mean, I think back to something. I can't imagine anything that made me want to play in a sport. And I mean, in college, but maybe I would have if I had the right inspiration. And it's good there are so many girls. But here's the thing, if that's the case, if it should be the role of the government to try to get people to do things that are fulfilling and fine, why shouldn't it be? Then why not also try to get them into orchestras or try to get the boys into drama clubs, try to get the boys to read? See, if it's about helping people flourish, why are we looking at something like that compared to something so fundamental? So it's not so much that I'm against. I'm not. I think the sports, and just as you say, and I have know so many young women that it's made a huge change in their life, being part of a team or something. But I would say that's also true of the all sorts of activities you're passionate about when you're young. So I think, but I see no reason why it should only be the areas where women need a little help. I think we could be fair-minded about it. Instead, we're actually taking away things from boys. I mean, just one last example about Berkeley is they're getting rid of this, they're sort of taking away this rugby team, and it's self-sustaining and self-supporting. It's a tradition. It doesn't take a penny from the school, but it throws off their numbers because they have 61 players. So by taking it off their varsity role, just making it a sports club or something, and in some schools they just get rid of it. So they're doing something, actually foreclosing on something that's already established, already a tradition. So that's why it doesn't make sense, for those two reasons. They're hurting something that was good that already existed, and I can't understand the reasoning. And there's so many ways in which young men should be encouraged. So I just want to encourage boys and girls and be attentive to all their needs, but we don't have the lobby for the boys. There's no 112 organizations. I don't think there's even one. There's some angry fathers groups. And that's about it. And they're not always, they're bitter and not always, it's not going to work. They're going to see, we need something more. And I don't know. So that's a problem. It's going to come to your generation.
One final question, anyone? I'd like to.
Can I ask you about your experience with John Stewart?
If there are no other relevant questions.
No, it's connected in some way. No, it isn't. But I was on his show for another book called One Nation Under Therapy, which I wrote with a psychiatrist, Sally Sattel, my colleague. And we simply looked at how our society, especially our young people, flourishing under this sort of hyper-protectiveness that we've developed. And just to throw out some examples that I told John Stewart about, we have schools where, and it does pertain to some of the topics that the schools where they're not allowed to play dodgeball, or, you know, tug of war has become tug of peace. And they're worried about rough and tumble play, and so the game of tag, one of the teachers' unions promoted this game called Circle of Friends, and it was tagged where no one was ever out. So they have all these ideas you've heard about, and all the self-esteem stuff. And we simply looked empirically at how are children faring under this self-esteem regime, and found that it's having the opposite effects that you would want, and it's especially hurting boys, because it's the one thing they like in school is being able to go out and run around, and you know, they might get hurt, can't have that, and it's competitive and so forth. And so, and he agreed with me. And at first he said, well, are you sure this is going on? Maybe this is just, you know. But I mentioned to him that, you know, teachers don't even use red pens. They're not supposed to use red pens to grade papers. And he said, what? You know, what are they? I said, we're supposed to use lavender. And then he said, well, maybe they should put a little potpourri on the paper. But then he
not
said, you must be exaggerating it. And in fact, the big pen makers, Dick and so forth, they don't make red pens now. I mean, they're very little because they're not bought by the old judgment.
How did you get booked? Did you just ask the producers, I want to talk about the book, or did they come to you?
I don't know how it, you know, it's probably the same now, but I've done three books, and when you do a book with Simon & Schuster, they have a publicity department, and then they try to get you everywhere they can. And those play, and it's mutual. They need people in there to come and tell stories and tell them about their books. And I would say John Stewart's a fair interviewer. I've seen him, you know, not always, but mostly he's been fair my friends. But the only thing about these shows, I've had a few colleagues that go on to that show, and they try to be funny and tell jokes, and I go, oh, that's so close. You just have to go talk about your book and hope for the best and laugh at him. But I did get a few laughs with one type of piece.
All right, well, thank you very much, Dr. Hoffman.